She was a dame, see? What a set of stems on you, gal.
Radio Drone.
I am Josh Hadley. I am rated R, and you know why. With me, as always, is Cecil PG-13.
No, I am like NC-17.
Well, then that makes Peter TV version.
Yes, there's a better cut of me floating around somewhere, but hasn't been released yet.
If you guys are looking for a release, though, what you do is go to adamandeve.com. What you do is you use the promo code DROME, and you would get 6 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, a gift for him, a gift for her, and free U.S. shipping, all for using the promo code DROME at adamandeve.com. Now, Cecil does exploring videos where he looks at the histories of movies and whatnot. He does videos on The Escapist for movies that are radically different or should be radically different from the way that they were made. Recently, he did one on The Crow, City of Angels, a movie I fucking despise. That piece of shit that I saw in the theater is not even worth talking about. On the other hand, the version Cecil said was actually made, I was more than interested in, although I've, you know, none of us have ever seen that. So tonight we're going to talk about alternate versions of movies. That's not just going to be lost versions, but alternate versions. Why do you think something like Crow City of Angels was released in such a truncated what the hell happened form as the piece of garbage I accidentally gave money to go see in the theater? Why do you think we probably will never see what the version that the director made?
Well, the thing is, it's simple. Like, there's a simple reason as to why it ended up the way it was. Harvey Weinstein, who was him and his brother were the producers, even though the director and the writer clearly laid out, this is the movie that we're making. We're making this movie. We're making a movie that is not The Crow. We're making a movie that it has the elements of The Crow, but it is a completely different story from the original Brandon Lee movie. So this is what we're doing. And they gave them the go ahead. And then they made that. And then when they came, you know, when they saw it, they were like, this, we didn't want this. And then basically took it away from them and reshot a good chunk of the film and made it into what it turned out to be. There was a combination of reasons. First being, like I said, Harvey Weinstein. The second being is that the movie was the original cut. Now, this is just the director's cut. This wasn't more than likely the cut that was going to be released into theaters. The first cut that they presented was 160 minutes. If you are a proper director, you always present a cut that is longer than the intended movie that you want, because the producers are always going to want something to edit. So you always leave something in there that you can remove. You know, you always put in something like, all right, this is the movie that I want to make, but I'm going to put a little bit of extra in there because I know that they're going to be like, could you trim it down? So if they presented a 160-minute movie and they trimmed it down to like maybe 130 or something, or 140, you know, basically cut it down, make them happy. It's too long, blah, blah, blah. And then they really freaked out. The other reason, because the movie was so long and because even if they did kind of trim it down, they wanted it to be more like the original Crow. And they also wanted it to be 90 minutes, because when you have a 90-minute movie, it's going to play more times in a week, in a day, than a 160-minute or 140-minute movie. So they went back, reshot the movie to be like the first Crow. And the big problem was that the movie was not intended to be that. So because they went back and reshot all this stuff, then they kind of jumbled it all together. And then people watched it and they're like, this doesn't make sense. This movie sucks. And it's like, well, yeah, that's because they turned it into something that it wasn't supposed to be. That's incredibly infuriating. And I can't imagine all, because the people that worked on it were heartbroken because they had dumped all this effort and just time and stuff into the movie. And then to have basically one guy come along and be like, nope, and just undo everything that they did. And then when the movie sucks, you don't see people bad. I mean, you see people like us bad mouthing him, but the general public doesn't know that this kind of stuff goes on. So they're like, ah, that director sucked, man, or that actor sucked. And they're just going after them. So that's just the major frustrating part of that.
Why do you think this happens? Why do you think that this kind of thing happens? Why do you think that the executives think that they know better than the person who actually made it? Because you usually have two reasons that a film is cut down: MPAA reasons or runtime. But you also have the "I know better." Why do you think that is?
Being the provider of the funds for the film, like for the money and stuff, the executives get it into their head that they're entitled to a chunk of the creative process where they can change things or have things reshot because they personally wanted something different or, like I said, they're offering up the money to do it, and suddenly they think they're filmmakers too, and they suddenly know better than the director and the writer and stuff like that. And it's complete bullshit because that can really break the movie. And it has broken a lot of movies that goes for, like, Blair Witch 2 was pretty much ruined in its theatrical release. Reindeer Games is a completely different movie from the theatrical release. And of course the whole Crow City of Angels thing where they completely turned it into the opposite of what it was meant to be. I think that really destroys the art that a movie can be and should be when it falls into the hands of an executive that thinks because he's offering up the funds that he can get his or her grubby little hands on the project and change things because they feel like they have the right to do it.
Well, then speaking of Harvey Scissorhands, he has a reputation of doing this. There's a few people he won't touch, like Quentin Tarantino and Kevin Smith have both said that Harvey has never tried to cut our movies, at least Kevin Smith, until they got to, you know, the Dogma era and whatnot. But like Tarantino is like, oh, Harvey's never tried to touch a frame of my movies. Well, that's because you're Quentin Tarantino. But what if you're like Richard Stanley? Now, Hardware we can't really use as an example because that was an MPAA nightmare. Submitted over 26 times before it got an R rating. That's a whole different topic. Look at Dust Devil. Dust Devil, we've all seen the full version now that came out. It came out on Laserdisc in the mid-90s, but then eventually came to DVD and Blu-ray. An amazing movie. Gorgeous film. Incredibly deep subtext and everything. Movie runs about 2.5 hours-ish. Do you guys remember how long the Miramax release version was?
80 minutes, I think.
81 minutes with credits. He cut almost an hour and a half out of the film against Richard Stanley's wishes and then said, no, this is the version that will play. And guess what? And guess what everybody said? This version makes no goddamn sense.
And if memory serves, it's been a while, but I believe that he put in unfinished effects in the film. Because I guess they were trying to save money.
Well, no, he was going off of the work print, which had unfinished effects, and he just basically had the work print mastered into his final scissored up version. So yeah, the VHS, it's hilarious. If you're a fan of Richard Stanley's Dust Devil, go and find the VHS cut, and you're gonna be just astonished that this thing exists. Sometimes. The different cut of a movie can make, like Peter pointed out with Reindeer Games, two totally different films. Now, I haven't seen the director's cut of Reindeer Games, but like we mentioned in the 1989 underwater movie episode, The Abyss, I can't stand the theatrical cut. I think the director's cut, 28 minutes longer, is a totally different film for The Abyss. Mm-hmm. It's only a half hour longer, but it's a completely different film. Same thing with Heaven's Gate. Heaven's Gate deserved its reputation of one of the worst films of all time, if you judge the theatrical cut. It wasn't until 1985, when the director's cut came out on Z Channel, that you went, wow, there's a good movie hidden in here. But that theatrical cut deserved its reputation of one of the worst films ever made. Different cuts of different films really make a difference. And then you go into the area of director's cuts. Now, Cecil, you've often said that you'll always side with the director. I don't always do that, but in most cases, yes, I agree with you. The director's cut should be the one that's seen.
Oh, I'm not saying that, like, look, their directors have been wrong before, but if it comes down to it, I will always side with the director unless there's something really fishy, like the whole recent Josh Trank thing with Fantastic Four.
Or like, Oliver Stone's Alexander.
Or Oliver Stone, yeah.
He released his director's cut to the theater, and then everyone hated it, so he recut it to a more commercially viable cut. And I'm like, that's just, you just sold out with Alexander. Oliver Stone is basically saying, I really want you people to like this movie, so I'm going to give you the version you wanted, not my version. Well, screw you, Mr. Stone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will always side with the director simply because they're the ones that have their name on the line. Like, they're the ones that are, this is their vision. They were hired to make this. This movie was their vision. And if the studio comes along and screws it up somehow and they want to change it or whatever, they're going to do it with impunity because people never pay attention to who the producers' names are. I'd say the majority of people will keep an eye on who the director's name is, but they could give a rat's ass who the producer is. And the producer ends up being the one that often will screw up a film.
When it comes to director's cuts, though, it's funny how a director's cut is a relatively new trend in Hollywood. Through the 60s and early 70s, that was the only version that was released, was the version that you saw. It was very rare to go back and recut a movie to suit either the director's vision or to make it more commercial or whatnot. That was very rare. So that's only an 80s and up thing. Isn't it funny how we often refer to director's cuts nowadays, and it is such a, in the history of film, such a relatively young trend?
I'm glad that came about, that we actually get to see the real version of it, and then we have one that we can compare to the theatrical. You know, you side with the director and you want to see their vision of it. And there are movies that I still really would like to see the true director's cut of. One of the biggest examples for me is, and it's a movie I already very much enjoy, and that's Exterminator 2.
The trailer for that is full of scenes that are not in the
film.
There
are scenes that were completely dropped from the film. It's because Cannon didn't like the version of the film was presented for whatever reason, and it seems like a movie I would like to see, because you have a different ending. For one, I would have liked to have seen that ending. I would have liked to have seen the pub shootout that happens, and all these scenes that were left out that I think would have made Exterminator 2 more of a sleazier film that was more in tone with the first film. We really get a tribute paid to that filmmaker. And just with all the different versions of movies that you got the director's cuts of Blade Runner, of Dune, and all that stuff. So it's something that I'm glad we're seeing more of, because there are better versions or just different versions of movies floating around that we haven't seen director's cuts of yet.
Probably because directors have gotten a little bit more clout over the years, because they've gotten names. Like, probably one of the first that really got people talking in terms of, you know, the director was Spielberg, because there was, you know, he had come out with movie after movie, and then people were like, oh my God, you know, this is another Spielberg movie. We have to see that. So his name kind of became attached to it. You had directors that would start to get more clout. And it is funny, because like now there are certain movies that will come out. It'll be like, you know, this movie directed by blah, blah, blah. Whereas normally they never would have said that, you know, normally it would have just been like, you know, here's the movie or whatever.
That kind of goes into how the Alan Smithy credit was created. I think it was 1962, Death of a Gunfighter. That movie was the first Alan Smithy film. To show how little matter the director had, or how little clout the director had, numerous trade magazines reviewed the movie and were commenting on how great Smithy's direction is. And as a new director, by the way, this was by a veteran who had 20 films under his belt, that how great of a career he's going to have in front of him for Death of a Gunfighter. That's how little clout it had, that no one even noticed that this is a veteran director who's using a pseudonym, and everyone just thinks it's a new guy. The director, I agree with you, until relatively recently, he didn't matter as much. But at the same time, the director can guide the movie, but sometimes they really do need someone else to step in. I can't even count how many movies I've seen where the director's cut is worse than the theatrical cut because the director had complete autonomy. He needed somebody to kind of pull back. Tarantino with Death Proof. Remember how when Rodriguez made Planet Terror, there's the missing reel, right? And there's obviously all this really big stuff that happens in the missing reel. Well, Rodriguez didn't film any of that because that's part of the joke of Grindhouse. Well, Tarantino filmed the entire movie and then just cut a reel out. Well, he put it back for the DVD. His words? Because the footage was just too good to not be seen. Because the guy's ego is so huge. And that 20 minutes he put back are some of the most boring, pointless, self-masturbatory shit I have ever seen. He needed somebody to go, no, Quentin, this was cut for the right reason.
That is why you do need to have a combination of things when you're making a film. You need to have a producer that understand. Well, you need, I mean, even if you have a director who is a loose cannon like Tarantino, you need to have a producer who knows when to give you leniency and knows when to call you on your shit. And you need to have an editor that will tell you to shut the fuck up. You need to have an editor that understands the way that you work and will take your movie and will cut it properly and be like, look, this scene of exposition, yes, there is a lot of great dialogue. There's some amazing acting going on here, but we already know this. The audience already will figure this out. If you have this really long scene in here where it's just talking and it kind of slows the whole pace of the film down, this needs to go. It's not essential. It needs to go. Put it on the DVD as a deleted scene, fine, but certain things have to go. So you really need a combination of, you know, a talented director with a vision. You need a producer who's not going to stick his dick where it doesn't belong. And you need an editor who is close enough to the director where he can tell him to knock it off.
Oh my God. With Death Proof, they were good to be left out of the movie because so much of that movie is bogged down by completely unnecessary. You expect the talkie scenes to be good in a Tarantino movie. Usually he writes fairly decent dialogue. In this case, more should have been cut. Because it was just a complete waste of Kurt Russell and just had this like random babble about nothing for almost 2 hours waiting for car chases to start. So yeah, Death Proof is a good example that sometimes the director's cut isn't the best cut. Sometimes it is. It can be the theatrical. I may be one of the rare people that actually thinks the theatrical and original like VHS and DVD release of RoboCop is better than the extended director's cut. I actually think that the extra gore, like, you know, seeing more of the dummy of Murphy that gets shot, the extended ED-209 stuff, I actually think it bogs the movie down a bit, and the theatrical and original home video release is actually a lot tighter. So sometimes in the rare case, a theatrical cut can be better than a director's cut. And I think Death Proof is a solid example of that. Though that's a movie that I think could have been different in a lot of ways, just a waste of Kurt Russell.
You also have directors like Albert Pyun. Albert Pyun and Orson Welles, both Orson Welles and Albert Pyun had their first film completely theirs, Citizen Kane and Sword and the Sorcerer. What we got were their cuts of the film. After that, neither one of those directors ever had final cut again. Albert Pyun has made over 40 movies, and he has said he has never even been allowed in the editing room past Radioactive Dreams, his second film. And even then, he didn't get his director's cut. On the other hand, you've got Orson Welles. Ever since Kane, he never had final cut. Even on masterpieces like Touch of Evil, that's not his cut of the film. So it makes you wonder just how different would Orson Welles' version of Touch of Evil have been? I mean, the closest we can get, because they can't find all of the footage, was they made an assembly cut based on Orson Welles' notes on the order and how certain scenes should play and whatnot. And the assembly cut of Touch of Evil is the closest we'll ever get to knowing what Orson Welles' Touch of Evil would have been like. It makes you wonder, like, Albert Pune, over 40 movies, and he's never even been let into the editing room, he said. He would turn in the footage, and then the studio would be like, all right, we'll call you for the premiere. Bye. That how a director should be treated in Hollywood, especially someone like Pune or Welles in the old days?
Christ, no. Like, Jesus Christ. Like, no. Albert Pune is he's an underrated filmmaker, but a very talented one. In his movies, usually the director's cut is better. Like the release of Nemesis that came out almost made no sense because, again, a lot of the expository stuff and story was cut to make room for more action, and it makes the movie make no sense. His version of it is better. I still need to see his cut of Cyborg. What is it? Slinger is like the Slinger. Original title. Yeah, I still haven't seen that, and I'd really like to because
his cut of Captain America does make more sense.
Slinger, let me tell you this. Slinger, the soundtrack for it is completely different. Like because the movie, it had like kind of a synth pop soundtrack, which it wasn't bad.
I never liked Cyborg.
But dude, the freaking Slinger version, the original soundtrack, is a full on metal soundtrack with guitar leads and all this like badass fretwork
which
going
would
on while they're fighting.
Because all the characters are named after guitars.
Exactly. They're all named after guitars. And it's like, it's just another thing. Yeah. I had to import Slinger, and it is, unfortunately, it is a really rough cut because it's stitched together from like VHS copies, work print and all that. And it's the better movie.
Wow.
I
definitely need to see that one because Jesus. Yeah. Just for that. Like I like the synth poppy soundtrack in Cyborg. But yeah, I mean, I can notice that a lot of story elements are cut. They're kind of sprinkled in here and there, but I do feel like there's a better movie in there than what we got, and I'm really looking forward to sitting down and watching that, even if it is a lot of like rough cut stuff.
Oh, it's still very watchable, but it's just that it's like, because you're watching it and it kind of it'll cut from like the mastered footage, and then it'll go into like the VHS print that's like kind of blown up. And it just gets very muddy. And I mean, I've seen many, work prints like that, that just, cause that was the only footage that was available. And it's just such a bummer. Cause it's like this, like, I think that the Cyborg, the movie that came out, was entertaining, but it wasn't like, it wasn't anywhere near what it should have been. And then watching Slinger, you're like, all right, this makes sense. This is not a award-winning film, but it is a competent, good, entertaining, kick-ass film that shouldn't have turned into what it did. Stay Alive is a great case of what happens when the guys who got hired to do the movie, they came in, I forget what studio it was, but they came in and they were like, okay, here's your budget. You can, you're making an R-rated horror film. And they were like, awesome. And they shot about 80% of it. And about that point, Disney bought the studio. And they were like, we don't want an R-rated film released under our label. So they took the film away from them and recut it to make it a PG-13 film. And because there was one really nasty subplot in the movie that was essential to explaining everything that was going on, they removed it entirely. So now you're watching the movie and then they're like, well, that doesn't make any goddamn sense. And it was all because they removed that section of the film. That's got to be infuriating. You're hired by one company. You're making the film that you were hired to do. And then Disney comes along and is like, nope. And just completely pulls the thing out from under you. I mean, that's got to, like, I could understand, like, I mean, it's as infuriating as it is when you're working for a studio. Like, you turn in your finished version of the film, and then whoever is in charge there decides to screw it over. But the people who hired you, they still wanted that movie. But then somebody else came along and took it over, and it's just maddening. It's so irritating. Mm-hmm. And how many movies have just been ruined?
Let's go back to like the Orson Welles thing. Mm-hmm. Orson Welles is regarded as one of the greatest directors in the history of Hollywood. And ever since Citizen Kane, he's never had final cut of one of his films. That's a very telling story, isn't it? When he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award in the 70s, John Huston accepted the award for him because he was still exiled in France. He had tax problems at that point, and if he'd set foot on U.S. soil, the IRS was going to descend on him. So John Huston accepted the award for Orson Welles, and John Huston basically gave the middle finger to Hollywood. His acceptance speech was, "How dare you people give Welles a Lifetime Achievement Award when you will not let him actually work in Hollywood?" One of the most respected directors ever doesn't get final cut.
What's extra infuriating about that is you look at the vast majority best movies ever made, and Citizen Kane is, well, more than likely, let's say you take 10 lists, and I'd say 9 out of 10 of them, they're going to put Citizen Kane as the best movie ever made.
In all honesty, most of those lists would also probably include The Magnificent Ambertons, The Fourth Man, and Touch of Evil.
Mm-hmm.
All from Orson Welles as well.
But I mean, yeah, exactly. So it's just maddening that it's like, here's a guy who obviously is a master of his craft. He knows what he's doing and he's brilliant at it. And you won't let him flourish. You know, you won't let him do, or at least simply, okay, you know what? We're going to do this movie, but we're going to let you have final cut. And if it, and then like I could see if they let him have final cut, like let's say they did a couple of movies and they cut it and then they gave him final cut on one. And then maybe it was like, okay, well, it didn't pan out or something. Then it would be like, okay, maybe he does need an editor or whatnot. But the fact that they never even gave him that opportunity. And the thing is, that was back in the day when, you know, we didn't have the director's cuts and all that. So it wasn't like even a possibility. Like now you're seeing things like, God, I never thought we'd get the completed version of Nightbreed. Clive Barker and...
It's still not a total complete version. There are still scenes that Clive wanted in there that he shot. They just can't find. So it's still not the version that he shot back
but
in 87.
It's as close to as it probably will ever be. And I mean, they went back, they had Doug Bradley re-record some audio, and they did a lot of like fixing on the movie. So the simple fact that that happened is amazing. So that's why I'll never give up hope that hopefully one day we'll get the Berlinger cut of Blair Witch 2. Hopefully one day we'll get Tim Pope's cut of Crow City of Angels, you know, other movies that have just since been butchered.
Well, it's ridiculous considering the man's first movie was Citizen Kane. And they don't trust him.
Well, you do have to remember, Citizen Kane bombed at the box office because of the controversy over Hearst. So his first movie, where we did give him final cut, almost got the studio sued and lost money. So you do got to look at it from that perspective, too.
I guess so. But I mean, it ended up, you know, becoming considered one of the greatest movies of all time. So it really is. It's ironic and it's infuriating that that a guy who produced that as his first film didn't get to have a final cut. Like that's as bullshit as it gets.
Well, how about when you have multiple cuts of the same film? And I'm not talking about like a TV edit, you know, being one of the multiple cuts. Let's look at like Blade Runner. I don't really like the final cut of Blade Runner, the new Blu-ray one. Maybe it's because I grew up seeing the other four cuts of the film, you know, constantly. Maybe, you know, just a fifth cut is too much for me. And we have never discussed this before. I don't know where either of you stand. I really like the narration in the original cut. I'm one of the people, I'm a narration booster. I think it gives it more of the noir feel that it was going for. It really cuts to the chase. It sums up characters perfectly. Like the first time we meet Bryant and he starts using the term skin job. And you're not quite sure exactly what skin job is in reference to the replicants. And the narration, Bryant's the kind of cop that in the 1950s would have called black men niggers. Right there. That sums up Bryant's character more than 5 minutes of screen time would have. And in a movie as paced as Blade Runner, you need that. The narration helps the film. Yes, the ending, the whole Shining ending is moronic, and you needed the unicorn scene. I give you that. I liked the narration. I'm a Blade Runner narration booster.
I like it without it. I like Ridley's cut better. I just think that the narration it's good, but it is a little too browbeating. But I mean, I've always been more of a show me, don't tell me kind of thing. Like, if you can express to me what's going on rather than having, you know, a narrator.
But it's also supposed to be like a sci-fi 40s noir tale, which the narration perfectly fits into.
She was a dame, see? What a set of stems on you, gal.
I do prefer the Ridley cut, the director's cut, but I do like the narration version too. I think with Blade Runner, the fun thing with that is that you have all these different versions of it that you can watch. I don't know if I've seen all five, maybe during the course of time that I grew to love the movie and stuff and saw different versions of it. But yeah, I like the Ridley cut, and I like the narration cut. That was the theatrical original home release, right?
For Blade Runner, the theatrical cut had the narration on it and the Shining ending, but did not have the unicorn scene. Then they released in Europe, there was the same cut as the theatrical, but it had more violence, more, you know, Chris gets shot more times, his fingers getting broken are more violent. It was stuff that was cut to get an R rating. Then you had Ridley's director's cut in 1993, but then right before that, they accidentally screened the work print, which had some of the Ridley Scott cut scenes and some of the scenes with the narration in the theatrical cut. It had the unicorn scene, but it also had the narration in the work print, and then you finally got the Blu-ray, what's called the final cut. So those are the five major cuts of Blade Runner. And wow. I love the movie. It's an important film. I just don't think it needs five official versions.
Yeah, for me, it's definitely, I prefer Ridley's cut, but I like the theatrical as well. I think those are my versions of Blade Runner. I like those.
You know, but then you've got like a director like James Cameron. He started to get known as the I'll wait till video for the director's cut. Terminator 2, theatrical cut, director's cut, massive improvement. Aliens, same thing. Abyss, same thing. True Lies, same thing. You kind of, after a while, you kind of went, why should I even go see a James Cameron movie in the theater? I'm getting a truncated, aborted version. When you have a director that's known for director's cuts, does that kind of undercut the theatrical version?
Well, I mean, he's kind of a rarity where he'll push out, you know, that version. And I guess Cameron knows how to play the game. He understands that, you know, the studios are going to want one thing and he's going to want to deliver another. And something like The Abyss was not a big moneymaker to begin with in the theater. So if it would have been even longer, it would have made even less money. It's nice that he at least is able to do that, because how many directors will just put out a version and then just, oh, well, you know, I wanted to do this version, but the studio wouldn't let me. So now I've moved on and I don't want to return to that. Because there's some directors who they don't like to go back. And that kind of bugs me, because it's like, well, your history is what got you to where you are now. Why wouldn't you want to have people see the version that you wanted, especially now with something like Blu-ray, where you've got the space that you can have both versions on the freaking disc.
In the case of James Cameron, I think with Aliens, gun scenes in the hallway, they're interesting. Some of the other dialogue scenes are interesting. The stuff with Newt's parents are interesting. It was absolutely ridiculous to cut the scene about Ripley's daughter. That scene is absolutely necessary to explaining her, in the theatrical versions, almost unnatural attachment to Newt. Mm-hmm. That scene, it's only a minute and a half or so long. You needed that scene in the theatrical cut. So I think it was ridiculous that even if you had to cut all the other stuff, that scene was cut. That scene was...
Yeah, that one really adds... it adds a great emotional level to the film, and it's the same... Same goes for Terminator 2, the theatrical and original home video release, cutting the dream sequence with Reese. Like that scene with Sarah dreaming about Reese and just Michael Biehn's performance, like that really adds to the character of Sarah Connor, and it adds a nice extra layer to the film. And cutting it just to me, the versions of the film that don't have those dream sequences and those like little extra moments, it really isn't Terminator 2 to me. Like I think James Cameron, his versions of his films are definitely a prime example of the director knows what he's doing, because that the whole daughter thing, because you don't even know that Ripley had a daughter in the first Alien. So in Aliens, when you find out about that she had a daughter that died, you know, years ago because she was floating around in space for so long, it really does explain her attachment to Newt, and it totally adds to the movie. Like, it's without that, the movie really doesn't work as well.
No, it doesn't. And to go back to Terminator 2, I think another absolutely necessary scene is where Sarah is taking out the Terminator CPU and tries to smash it. Because otherwise, you go from her completely distrusting Arnold to being okay with him. You needed that transition scene where she had to battle herself and John into realizing they needed him.
Yeah.
Now, I realize that was like a 7-minute scene, so that can really, you know, it kind of, the pacing is a little wonky with that. But then look at Ridley Scott when it comes to pacing. Look at Prometheus. Prometheus, what was the number one complaint theatrically? The film makes no sense. The characters have no motivation for what they do. The film is jumping all over the narrative, and it makes no sense. 90% of the makes no sense were covered in deleted scenes. Why were those scenes deleted? They wrecked the pacing of the film. Ridley Scott literally made the movie make no sense at all, so it would be better paced. That, I think, is just asinine.
Yeah.
Who gives a shit about the pacing if it makes no sense?
Exactly.
There are so many scenes in Prometheus that just make no sense because they have no context to them.
Yeah.
Because Ridley removed all of the context because, well, it wrecked the pacing. My question to you is, would you rather have Prometheus paced really well or make fucking sense?
There's a happy medium. You can still keep the pacing and figure out a way to edit in things to have it make sense. You can break scenes up. You can put things in. You can come back to them. Like, there are clever tricks that you can do to not bog down the script. If there's something that needs to be in there, but you've got it shot, but you can't go back and, you know, reshoot it or do it differently, or there are clever ways that you can get it in there. So just removing something outright, it's not a good way to go about doing something. So when you're making a film, you really have to make sure that it's like, okay, well, this is a very important scene that is going to explain what's going on. We need to get it into the movie, but we need to make sure that it is engaging enough that people aren't going to tune out. But on the same token, though, there are a lot of scenes in movies that are a lot of dialogue, and they're really interesting because the acting is good or the story is good, but people tune out because they have ADD and they can't pay attention to dialogue past 3 seconds unless there's an explosion. That kind of bugs me to a certain degree. And I know you hate when a director just can't stop editing.
So, I can't stand the rapid fire editing.
Yeah, that bugs the hell out of me too, where it's like, oh my God, you know, you can have something go on for longer than 10 seconds.
What about when we as Americans get the truncated cut, but the Europeans get the real cut of the film? For instance, I'm glad I saw Leon the Professional before I ever saw The Professional, because the American version, The Professional, is a piece of shit. If I had seen that first, I highly doubt I would have ever given the Leon version a chance. And I think Leon the Professional is an amazing film. The American version, it was like, what the fuck was that? Or another one would be Brazil. Brazil, when released in 1985, was being hailed by European critics as one of the best movies of the entire 1980s. Roger Ebert and some of the American critics were going, are you nuts? This movie's horrible. Why? Well, the version all the American critics were seeing was missing 28 minutes of footage.
Oh,
and
God.
Made no sense and had a different ending to it. Gee, I wonder why nobody liked it. Or another one, Life Force. Life Force was released minus 17 minutes in America. Bombed with critics and in the theaters. European audiences were hailing this as, oh my God, this is like a Nigel Neal movie on a huge budget. This is fantastic. What about when the Europeans get the real version and we get shit?
I feel lucky when it comes to Leon the Professional, for one, because that is the only version of it that I've seen. And I didn't know
watching
there was another...
The Professional, the American version, is trying to like watch the TV version of I Spit on Your Grave. There is so much missing that you just, I mean, it's even full of jump cuts because of how much they edited out.
Yeah, it's really sad. It's not something that I've had too much trouble with. I guess, I don't know, we might get the extended or original cuts earlier in Canada or something. And I am originally from Europe as well, so that probably makes it easier too. So yeah, I've only seen the full director's cut version of Leon the Professional, the real version of Life Force, stuff like that. So I'm lucky in that regard. You know, the real cut of Brazil, stuff like that. So yeah, that really sucks. Especially, how can you show that like a completely edited down, you know, 20 to 30 minutes missing? How can you show that to critics and actually expect like real decent reviews, like or any like honest kind of reviews when it's not actually the full movie?
Well, in the case of Brazil, Sid Sheinberg's reasoning, he was the head of Universal at the time, his reasoning for cutting the movie as severely as he did was audiences are different. European audiences will like your artsy-fartsy version. American audiences need it shorter, they need the edit tighter, and they need more action. And they want to have and American audiences want a happy ending.
That's such crap.
What Sid Sheinberg's rationale was for why he released that severely truncated piece of crap in America. Because I think the director's cut of Brazil, the European cut, is in my top five favorite movies of all time. The theatrical cut is a goddamn mess.
It's just such, that's borderline retarded reasoning, because if you want to talk about Europe and shit like that, you're talking about the land of remake exploitation and people that are known to be obsessed with like Mad Max and Rambo and doing their own versions
to,
of it.
I think he's more referring to England, France, that kind of Europe.
I guess, but still, my point still stands. Like they love action movies over there. Like especially like, you know, in Italy or where I come from, Serbia, we really love the action stuff, the Schwarzenegger stuff, Stallone stuff. So it's just stupid to assume, oh, they just like the artsy stuff. No, they Europeans love action and shit like that just as much as Americans do. So it really is just asinine reasoning.
A good one is the European cut of Eyes Wide Shut. In the American version, they were so panicked because, a large part of the movie takes place at this orgy that they put in...
Oh, are you talking about the digital people?
Yeah, they put in digital people and the digital planters and stuff that were, you know, blocking so you couldn't see
and
people having sex.
Obvious as hell.
Yeah, that stuck out like a sore thumb. And it kind of undercut the entire... OS, I shouldn't be here thing. Like there was stuff going on that like you couldn't see where it's like where Tom Cruise realizes, oh, I really should not be here. And so that kind of made the whole intensity of the scene, like it deflated it. So when he's finally brought before the council and they're like, how did you get here? They're interrogating him and they find out who he is. You're like, there's no real fear. It's like, all right, a bunch of perverts are having sex and you're not really seeing, oh, this is something that, you know, he shouldn't, you know, that he's the wrong person to be here. So they cut that out just horrendously. And then going on to the happy ending thing, same thing happened with City of Angels. Crow, the City of Angels had a horrible, depressing ending, but they turned that into a happy ending. Why? Why would you do that? You know, they've gotten the longer version. They've gotten the artsy, you know, quote unquote artsy version. But then the thing is, like people will, there are a lot of people that will complain that they're like, you know, well, we want the artistic version. We want that version. They'll see that version and they'll like it. But then you get a lot of people that go to the theater that are like, it was too long. It's too much talking. Leon, I actually saw The Professional first. And then I saw Leon years later, and I thought...
Am I wrong that The Professional is a terrible version of that film?
Oh, absolutely. The Leon is the version that, you know, should have been released. I think the thing was, The Professional, when it came out, I was really enjoying the kind of wave of crime movies that we got, because Romeo Is Bleeding... And
Bleeding is a fantastic film, by
the way. Romeo Is Bleeding is a fantastic film.
Lena Olan is the most badass one-armed assassin you will ever encounter.
Yeah, she was fantastic. I loved her. So that was the whole thing. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't...
Roy Scheider was in that, and he cut one of Gary Oldman's toes off.
That's it. I'm saying Gary Oldman. I'm like, Gary Oldman was in that one too, you know, so, but yeah, that movie is so good. But I was really digging the whole, that we're getting all these like cool crime movies. And so I saw The Professional and I thought it was like, I thought it was good. I thought it was, you know, it was kind of cool. And I liked the whole thing. And then years later, I saw Leon and I was like, okay, this is a much better film. This is the film that should have been. The thing with Leon too, one of the things that I don't think you mentioned, they never went into it, but there definitely was a sort of, there definitely was some sort of attraction between Matilda and Leon. And I know that
it was a one-way attraction, because there was actually a scene that's not in any in any version of the film. She tries to pay him back for his kindness by sleeping with him, and he turns her down, which I think is a very powerful scene, a scene that completely defines their relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a scene that even European audiences were kind of like, okay, might be a little too far, because, you know, she's 12.
Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, well, I'm saying, okay, I like, he definitely kept doing the, you know, the spit takes. So but what I mean is that, like, he was kind of coming at her from a, I don't want to say parental, a mentor thing. And she was falling in love with the mentor. And so that, but the thing is, so American audiences wouldn't, that was more or less what I was getting into. Not so much a mutual thing, but he was a mentor who was, you know, looking at her from that perspective, and she was falling in love with him. American audiences would have immediately screamed pedophile. And
they actually, one of the big cuts, Miramax absolutely refused to have the scene where they're in bed together. Now, they're not having sex. They literally are just sleeping in the same bed together. And he's on top of the covers. Yeah. She's under the covers. They're both fully clothed. And they're both just literally sleeping on a bed together. Miramax went, no!
Brazil, I have not seen the longer cut. And Life Force is another one where I saw the theatrical cut. And I still liked it. I mean, I liked...
doesn't make any sense, but yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. I liked Matilda May walking around naked for the whole film. And that was, you know, I very much enjoyed that. But
Patrick Stewart's screaming his head off.
Yeah, just,
No. Patrick Stewart's first on-screen kiss with Steve Railsback.
Yes.
No, he told that story on The Tonight Show. He's kind of embarrassed. His first on-screen kiss was with a dude.
I think that, I had only ever seen that version for the longest time. And then when Shout Factory or Scream Factory put out the Blu-ray, I got that. And I was like, oh, this is great. Because now, you know, now this, like, really neat movie makes sense. Before, it was like, I'm like, okay, I like this. I don't particularly understand everything that's going on, but I think that it's neat.
To be fair, they weren't the ones that put that out for the first time. The Laserdisc that came out in 1994, I think it was, of Life Force was the European cut. So that cut had been floating around since the 90s. Do you think that we're getting better with it or getting worse? For instance, like how every DVD that comes out now is the uncut, unrated version you didn't see in theaters. It's usually pointless scenes that mean nothing, like Pitch Black. I was so disappointed when Pitch Black came out unrated. I was like, oh, more gore, more swearing? No, it's two pointless scenes that literally add nothing to the film whatsoever. So are we moving backwards or forwards when it comes to cuts of films that we all get to see?
Well, I think since it became such a big groundbreaking thing from the 80s and into the 90s of directors giving a true fair shake and being allowed to put out their cut of the film. And it became such a big thing that every movie has to be like that, where the version you saw in theaters is, you know, it's not as intense or as violent or whatever as the one you saw, and the one you're getting on DVD and Blu-ray is this completely different movie. And a lot of the time, it is, as you said, it's like two extra scenes and hardly anything actually changes. It's simply because it's become the giant thing that it is, the whole director's cut being this big deal. But it's really only a big deal when the movie is known for being as cut as it was in theaters. And you know for a fact that It was meant to be edited a different way. There were scenes missing that told the story better. Like, you look forward to a James Cameron cut or a Ridley Scott cut, whereas nowadays it's like every movie is the unedited, unfiltered, shut up.
It's
like,
become the standard.
Yeah, it's just a thing that almost every movie is doing now, just to garner more money and profit from the film, whether...
Well, because it used to be so rare. Listen to the commentary on the on the DVD for Lord of Illusions. Now, obviously, DVDs didn't exist when the movie came out, but Clive said the deal he made was, I will make an R-rated theatrical cut for you as long as I get director's cut on Laserdisc. And they said, deal. So, you know, even back then, it was sort of, well, you know, the Laserdisc is where my cut will be seen. Now it's just, you're right. It's the standard now.
I think it's depressing because it used to mean something, and I'm glad that they do, but it is a cop-out for the studio, because what they can do is they'll take a movie that was shot R, cut it to PG-13 and release it in the theaters, and then they'll, you know, put the unrated cut on DVD, the version that everybody should have seen. The downside to that is twofold. Number one is that the majority of the people that will see it in a theater, if they see the PG-13 film and it sucks, well, that's going to cut into the sales of the DVD, because there's going to be a lot of people that are like, oh, I'm not going to watch that. I heard it sucked. And then the other thing, too, is there have been a lot of movies that were shot as R that were cut to PG-13. And then when they went to release them on DVD, they didn't bother to release the unrated cut, because they're like, well, this movie sucked and nobody wanted to see it, so we're not going to put forth the effort to actually release the version that people should see. So it ends up really screwing them over.
And then you also have the example of lost scenes, like Exorcist 2. Exorcist 2 was released to theaters and was such a disaster that they literally pulled it out of theaters for one night, and John Boorman recut the movie and cut 8 minutes out of it, which have never been seen unless you saw it opening week. That footage that nobody knows what happened to that 8 minutes he cut out. It's the same thing with 2001. That lost 17 minutes after its first week. They never kept the footage. So the only way you saw the full version of 2001 is if you saw it the first week it was open in 1968.
Jesus.
There is a whole bunch of lost footage, but that's a different topic. Peter, I guess you've been upgraded from the TV version to the cable TV version. Where can people find you?
I'd like to think of myself as the European Laserdisc cut. That's very rare to find.
You're the Spike TV edit.
Oh, God, no. That's the worst edit. You can find, I promise you, not the Spike TV edit. If you go to @Cinematica on Twitter, Cinemasochist on YouTube, Cinemasochist on Facebook. And you can also find the European Laserdisc copy of me at 1201beyond.com, and also Josh Hadley and t-shirts and lots of awesome stuff.
Cecil, where can people find the pristine Blu-ray that happens to have a scratch in it that is Cecil T?
Oh, no. The pristine uncut version of me at escapistmagazine.com, goodbedflix.com, YouTube, Twitter, everywhere else.
Twitface, all of it.
Stuff.
You can find me at 1201beyond.com. You can contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com. And guys, remember, keep one foot in the gutter, one fist in the gold. Let's try to stay a cut above. Have a good night. You play. Keep the dream alive. You gotta read.
Radio Drone is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.